and welcome to Quarantine Zone, a podcast for HBO's The Last of Us. We are your hosts, Andrew Sorsini,
Dwayne D.
and Tosin Anofowakin.
So just a little intro to us, if you're not familiar with us. We have hosted a number of podcasts previously, a tech podcast called The Drill Down, and we most recently hosted a podcast for Westworld called Violent Delights. And Westworld has ended. We're not getting a season five on that, unfortunately. But you know what interests all of us, I think, was the idea of HBO creating an adaptation of The Last of Us. So we're like, we're going to jump on that and we're going to cover that.
So, totally. Yeah. Totally. I feel like the, you know, we did American Gods for the first two seasons. Right. We did Westworld for its entire run. And now we're at The Last of Us. And part of this, this kind of podcasting that we do is going into why the adaptation works or doesn't work. So with the American Gods, it seemed great. Then it kind of fell apart. And then with Westworld, it kept on surprising us. So, you know, it's exciting to see what they're going to do with The Last of Us.
Yeah, I think one of the distinctions that I feel, to our credit, sets us apart from other after-show podcasts is that we try to avoid simply recapping and really get into more deconstructing these episodes. So hopefully, if that's something you're interested in, if you're interested in our sort of deconstruction of The Last of Us series, tune in to us. We don't have all of our links set up yet, but in the meantime, one that we do have for sure is our Twitter, which is at QZ Pod.
QZ stands for Quarantine Zone.
Absolutely. Yes.
So yeah, if you like an open-faced sandwich, you're going to love the Quarantine Zone.
Yes. So what we wanted to cover with this first initial pre-show, pre-series episode was just our relationship with The Last of Us and our relationship with the creatives that are involved in the show and what we expect in the road ahead for the series. So I want to start off with, I'm going to start with you, Tosin. Let me ask you, what is your relationship to The Last of Us video game?
Yeah, so I have played part of the first Last of Us video game. You know, I'm pretty bad about finishing video games. There's only certain titles that I actually go through completely, such as like Spider-Man or God of War. I bought Last of Us pretty early, but the thing about that game is just it's so emotional. It's emotionally intense and draining at times that it was just like, sometimes it's just hard to want to pick that up after you know, a crazy day of work. And then also at parts, it's fairly chilling, you know? I wouldn't say like horror is like, I'm not against it, but I don't gravitate to watching those type of films. And when you have those like clackers around the corner and you're trying not to be caught and you're like the only one in like a dark room at night, you're just like, maybe I'll play something with a little bit more sunshine.
But I see Tosin like moving over to Bastion or something.
Yeah, but you know, I really do enjoy the work of art as someone who has always been a fan of I'm gonna say indie games, even though at this point in time it's gotten much, much bigger than that. But it started off as a, you know, it had backing and money, but it started off as a not well known title. Just in love with the creativity, the work, the personality, and the story. To compare it a little
bit. Before you go on, I just want to say, like, you're not just talking about how you like indie games, like, you go to PAX, or at least before the pandemic, you were always at PAX, PAX East, PAX West, PAX Northwest. Like, you are like the indie game guy of our little group. That's just who you are. Just want to put that out there.
And I just love covering. I'm although I don't necessarily make time for many games these days, I'm still a fan of gaming. And as I was kind of alluding towards, one of the things that I really love is like story and really well thought out story. So, for example, you see a lot of that with the Telltale series. They had Tales from the Borderlands. They've had the whole Walking Dead series, and a lot of those are, less about the action and more about the story and the decisions you make along the way. And that's something that Last of Us series has given. And so I think really cool. As far as the like sequel, I definitely followed a whole bunch of that. Especially there was I don't know if you guys ever saw the trailer video with guitar playing.
Oh, yeah.
One of the characters is playing guitar. Well, you can play the guitar as that character, and it's super accurate in terms of the fingering everything. So anyway, I think very excited to see how they try and translate from this game into a series. So that's my background with it.
Dwayne, how about you? What's your relationship to The Last of Us?
All right, so back in the day, I don't even remember what year it was. I got a used PS3 from a friend, right? He was upgrading to, I guess, the PS3 Slim, and I wanted to play some PS2 games, so I got his original PS3.
Yeah.
And I started playing, Resident Evil. And here's the thing. I don't watch scary movies, but I play scary games. So, Resident Evil or whether it's The Last of Us or Left 4 Dead, or why can't I remember the name of the underwater city one with the little creepy girl? American McKee's BioShock. Alice. Like, I love, yes, BioShock, exactly. And BioShock is creepy because of like the social stuff too. But American McKee's Alice. I love these kind of scary games. I am the guy who wants to play the game in my, at my desk alone after everyone else has gone to sleep. And, I do jump and, I get killed and I start over, all that stuff. The Last of Us, what was special was one of my buddies, he's an author, he was around and, our wives were doing something. He was in Boulder and both of our wives were out doing something. They're best friends from the time they were kids. And we got like a copy of The Last of Us. We popped it in the PS3 and we just took turns going back and forth trying to go forward in it. And, he was visiting us for like 3 or 4 days and we burned through like 80% of the game together, just handing the controller back and forth. Okay. One person saying, okay, look over there. Okay. I'm seeing this thing in the corner, like two sets of eyes and the same thing. And it was one of the most fun experiences I've had with a game. Storytelling is fantastic. It's a PS3, but the graphics were great. And I just felt immersed for the first time. And then, of course, the kind of like tandem play that we were doing allowed us to feel even more immersed, right? So it was a good bonding experience. And because of the emotions of the game and because of the sort of like, just the general premise of the story, like the loss, all that stuff, I just felt pulled in. And I gotta say, I haven't been pulled into a game that much since that game. I've tried, I really enjoy Zelda, but I haven't been really like moved by a game. It felt both adult, like grown up, and it made me feel like a kid again at the same time. So I'm a huge, huge fan. I haven't played a lot of the second one, but I've played a little bit, and I like where they took the story, how the characters aged up, all that stuff. So I'm just I'm a big fan of how they tell the story, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how they try to adapt it. And as we'll talk about later, video game adaptations haven't always gone so well.
That's correct. Yeah, no, my relationship with the video game is, I'm a huge fan of the games that I gravitate towards tend to be the ones with really fleshed out storytelling and fleshed out world building. And there was a period of time in the early 2000s, I would say, where there were these heavy hitters who were just creating just this amazing content. And Neil Druckmann is one of the ones, with the creator of The Last of Us, the video game, is one of the ones with both The Last of Us and Uncharted series. Also the BioShock series and basically anything coming out of Valve.
BioShock is just so incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. All of that stuff was the appeal for me is that they really did flesh out these, these worlds and have this amazing emotional this storytelling with a real emotional core, which is rare.
Can we talk about how Uncharted 3 made you feel, just for a second?
Well, yeah. I mean,
not Uncharted 3. BioShock 3.
BioShock. Oh God. BioShock 3. Forget it. I was a wet, sobbing mess at the end of BioShock Infinite.
I didn't believe you when you told me that.
Oh, my God.
I got to know you more, yeah, I realized wow, he really was a wet, sobbing mess at a video game.
Have you played BioShock Infinite?
I've played it a little bit.
You need to play it to the end, because that's where...
I wasn't moved as much as you are, but I understand how one could be moved.
Oh, my God.
Was this pre-children or post-children?
This was...
Well, for Andy, it was post-children.
Post-children, yeah.
But for you, Dwayne,
it was pre-children for me, for sure. I've got a couple kids, and yeah.
Well, let's circle back to that too, because there's also a connection with The Last of Us. So the first time that I was ever intrigued about the idea of The Last of Us, I was watching Planet Earth, David Attenborough's miniseries about. Nature miniseries about the life on planet Earth, all the different species. I don't know if
how beautiful it is, how in danger it is.
Yes. So yeah. there was a tiny segment of that miniseries where he talked about insects, and in particular this fungus that affects insects, the cordyceps. And there was some just beautiful photography of all of these insects being infected by this cordyceps fungus, which leads them to essentially to become vulnerable and have this fungus sprout out of their brains and infect other insects of their species. And there was one line in that.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
There was one line in the segment of that show that really struck me, and it was that every species has their own individual variant of this cordyceps fungus. And immediately I thought, well, God, what if that like extrapolated to humans at some point?
Every species of ant?
Every species of different species of insects, grasshoppers, walking stick.
But they were focused
insects.
On the insect clade. They weren't. Okay, he's checking.
Yes. So, but it chilled me to the bone to imagine if that fungus suddenly affected humans the same way. Well, since that, I think that segment of that show was the inspiration for the fungus that's in The Last of Us. It was also the inspiration for a book series that started with The Girl with All the Gifts has the same cordyceps fungus at the heart of it. But when The Last of Us came out, I got it for my PS3, and going back to what a weepy mess I was on BioShock Infinite, the storytelling was so moving. There is a prologue to the video game of The Last of Us, which I will not spoil here, but I think that they're going to recreate that prologue in the series. And it was so devastating. It was like a video game equivalent of the first 10 minutes of Pixar's Up. It was so devastating to me that I had to put down the controller, and I could not play the game again for like 3 months because
quarter of a year.
Yeah,
earnings reports came and went, and you were like, I can't play this game.
I can't play this video game. It was too emotionally devastating for me. And it will probably be emotionally devastating for, let's just put it this way. If you're a parent, it'll be emotionally devastating. So ever since then, I've been really emotionally drawn to this, to the video game, and to have a video game move you is a rare thing for me, to move you in the same way that a movie or a TV show does. That's a testament to the show creator. So I never did finish the Last of Us. I will say I got stuck at a certain point where the stealth mechanics just proved too challenging for me. So But I'm looking forward to a PC version, and I'll try it again. But I love the idea, and that's my relationship to the video game.
Can I just bring that up, the stealth mechanic? So one of my favorite games as a youngster was this game called Thief. Have you guys heard of this game?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so Thief, you know, takes place in a kind of like mythical Dungeons and Dragons almost kind of world. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And your job, unlike every other first person, it's a first person experience, but it's not a first person shooter because your job is to not be seen by the AI, which for its time was quite tricky.
Right.
And the whole point is to sneak around, you know, and then you walk your character into something that's stealing back in the day. And then you got to get out of there and hopefully you don't knock anything over or like raise the alarm, basically like Grand Theft Auto when you get 5 stars and everybody's after you. Right. So when I started playing The Last of Us, one of the things that really brought me back to was Thief. And again, sure. Thief is one of those games you play in the middle of the night when you're by yourself and you got your earphones on and you're trying to like listen out for all the like little things. And The Last of Us also brought me back to that experience. So, I'm really
Metal Gear Solid is another example of that kind of thing where stealth is the entire mechanic behind it.
Yeah, I mean, I did enjoy stealth in Metal Gear Solid, you know, as well as my cardboard box.
Yes,
but for me, like, and I do enjoy stealth in some games. Sometimes it is fun to just kind of run and gun too. Like,
I mean, there's so many games that do that though. So when you're presented with the game that like you can't use that skill set, that to me is what's up.
Yeah, and so I think even some of like the Batman and Spider-Man ones, they have stealth components. But the problem for me with this one, it's not really a problem. It's just the scare factor plus stealth plus this sense of vulnerability that you have with the others, right? So like even with Metal Gear Solid, you're still supposedly this incredible ancient veteran, you know, basically commando style or Batman, you are a superhero. And although in a lot of those cases, if you fail those stealth components, you don't survive, you still feel like you're very empowered. And in Last of Us as a game, you had like a few bullets and even that was not going to help you. And and it's also the it also has the, can't remember the name of it, you guys are gonna have to help me here, it's basically the escort mission, the save the princess component, where the concern here is not just yourself but it's this other character even
that you can't control, it's always an NPC.
And even though like you can't do anything about it, it just feels emotionally more devastating when you lose, and so does this character.
I mean, that's one of the things I loved about Bioshock Infinite is your escort, the person you're escorting there, she was very capable and she would actually help you out and you never had to worry about too much.
It's like Tails in Sonic.
Let's talk about coming over from the video game to the series will also be the creator of the video game and the writer, head writer Neil Druckmann, as well as the composer Gustavo Santaolalla, who did just the score
music makes a video.
Oh my god! And that video game in particular was so poignant. The music in that was so poignant. So I'm looking forward to.
I mean, music makes everything. If you didn't have music, would Star Wars be here? I don't know.
Yeah, it's true. Let's talk about people who are involved and what your relationship is to their work. The other person besides Neil Druckmann, who is co-show running this show, is Craig Mazin. And my relationship to him is that he was the showrunner and creator of the Chernobyl miniseries on HBO, which was
I couldn't get through that.
Phenomenal.
So good.
It was good, except I couldn't get through it because it's hard.
Dwayne's crying.
I didn't cry. I was like,
his emotional.
Guys, I made it through 11 seasons of The Walking Dead. I couldn't make it through like 5 episodes of Chernobyl. Talk about dark.
Yes, it's dark. But I think I think Craig Mazin is the perfect person for this, and we'll get into this just a little bit later. But I think that the history of adapting video games to live action properties has not been
a dark history.
It's a dark history, and Craig Mazin, because of his work on Chernobyl, represents a light at the end of that tunnel, that dark tunnel. So I'm hoping. Tosin, you saw Chernobyl, the whole miniseries?
Yes, I saw it and really enjoyed it. It's definitely one of my favorite miniseries. I listened to their podcast as well, which is a great compendium of that. There is also another like Chernobyl tapes or something that's currently on HBO that I do want to check out, but I haven't gotten a chance. But yes,
it featured my like favorite actor who always kills himself, Chernobyl.
Jared Harris, you're talking about.
That's right. Yeah, you get on Mad Men, you get on Chernobyl. Yeah. You know, that guy's around, expect the noose, right? Yes. Or he was in The Crown and he just like dies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like one day she wakes up and he's dead and you're like.
But he dies a king. So.
Yeah. You know, not quite Sean Bean, but very close second.
The two lead actors of the show are Pedro Pascal and Bella Ramsey. Now, Pedro Pascal,
he's everywhere right now.
This man is like on fire. Like
he's the hardest working guy in fantasy and science fiction.
He has had like a blessed career the last 10 years, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, he was in Game of Thrones. He was in a Wonder Woman sequel.
Yes.
I think he's going to be most remembered for his role on The Mandalorian, even though you don't see his face.
Right.
He was in The Good Wife as a regular guest star, which is a pretty award-winning show. And he is
Narcos, which was awesome.
He was in Narcos on Netflix. Back when Netflix was like kind of blown up with the kind of prestige original content, they know it was him.
He carried the unbearable weight of massive talent. If you've seen that,
such a fun movie, it's fun.
And then of course we talked about The Mandalorian, and then of course he's going to show up in this. So yes. You know, a very talented actor. He's very versatile. You don't necessarily see him playing the same shtick,
right.
And that's key because. You know, with a lot of actors, not that they're not versatile, but like whenever I see a Tom Cruise movie, it doesn't matter if he's playing Ethan Hunt or whatever. He's just Tom Cruise to me.
True, true.
But I do believe that Pedro Pascal is the Mandalorian, right?
Yeah.
I do believe that that he was, you know, that Dornish
Oberyn Martell.
Yeah, Oberyn Martell, right? He was a Martell. So he really does encapsulate these roles. Despite his very distinctive look, and I'm looking forward to how he holds this character in the show. Speaking of Game of Thrones, who's the other person that's talked to us about Bella Ramsey?
Bella Ramsey. So all of us watched all of Game of Thrones, right? We watched all the seasons. So you remember Bella Ramsey?
Unfortunately, we saw the end of Game of Thrones.
So in those last, I think it was couple of seasons, Bella Ramsey showed up as Lyanna Mormont. And I got to say
Lyanna named for Stark's sister who passed away and caused the entire scenario that set up the Song of Ice and Fire Game of Thrones. Lyanna Mormont.
Yes. So when, you know, she was, I didn't know of her before Game of Thrones, but I will say that her like brief moments on screen as Lyanna Mormont, she like stole those scenes, and I found myself like being in awe that this little kid was able.
She was about 10 or 11 years old, it seemed.
Yeah, but she had so much confidence as Lyanna Mormont, like standing her ground. And being this young ruler, like I totally believed it. Yeah.
So also that in that scenario, you know, they have like a kind of Salic law in that universe. So the idea that she, both a minor and a little girl, you know, a young female ruler was outside of bounds for what's going on in there. And so the fact that she was able to do that and pull it off, and pull it off in front of the other characters in the show who are like misogynistic.
Right.
That was so powerful, because she was able to pull that off. Yeah, you're right. She stole every scene. And she does, you know, she's not some like kind of like Hollywood typical. Like dark haired, her features are more like close, you know, she's got like a little chin, like she's just very diminutive.
Sure.
And I think her carrying this role is going to be very interesting to see, because she's clearly not going to be a version of Lyanna Mormont. She can't be, right?
No.
This is a very, very different role. So we know she has a talent, so I'm excited to see how she's going to play it.
I just watched another movie with her the other day. It's on Amazon Prime. It's called Catherine Called Birdie. And it's based on a young adult book. But she is the lead actor in that movie. And she did a fantastic job. And I'm like, this kid has so much talent that this...
You almost wonder why she wasn't on Stranger Things.
She's British also, so I think she would have... Not that there aren't British actors on Stranger Things. But
yeah.
I think this is really going to be her...
Breakout.
Her breakout role. And I'm really looking forward to... Not necessarily... Like, I would have expected a... maybe a more seasoned actor as Ellie, but I think,
I mean, she did play Lyanna Mormont in the most awarded TV show
true.
In history. So.
That's true. She did such a great job in Game of Thrones, in the stuff that she's done so far, that I'm really excited about seeing what she does with this role. And rounding out the cast is Anna Torv, who I know from Fringe and Mindhunter. I don't know if you guys have seen either of those shows.
I've seen some of Fringe. I haven't seen Mindhunter.
I saw the first season of Mindhunter. I believe it was the first season. I did enjoy it.
I kept on confusing it with Beastmaster.
I love mysteries, and you know, this was sort of investigative and psychological films. This is in the same vein as Silence of the Lambs.
Sure.
Mm. It's very much the same band.
It's about a team of profilers. Yeah, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And Anna Torv was sort of like she represented the CIA executives, the deputy chief of the
corporate.
She represented the higher ups that ran the division of profilers. And in Fringe, of course, she played Olivia Dunham, who was the central character of Fringe. I thought she was fantastic. And also Gabriel Luna, who probably is unfamiliar to a lot of people.
Is he related to Diego Luna?
I don't think so.
Just checking.
But he was on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as Ghost Rider. He did a great job, I think, with, you know.
And given how Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was written by the time Ghost Rider showed up, you know, when you say he did a great job, you know.
I was really. And Marvel has had like this long history of when they cast a character, an actor for a character, that actor is that character throughout the entire MCU.
You ride or die.
Exactly. So
the modern Marvel situation.
I was kind of hoping that at some point Ghost Rider would show up in the MCU and we'd get Gabriel Luna again. So I'm excited about him being in this cast as well. Okay, so before we wrap up this episode, let's talk about like the big elephant in the room, which is video game adaptations to screen, which, as we've mentioned, has not had a stellar history up to this point.
So for anyone who doesn't know, you know, Andy, Tosin, and I, we've been friends for a long time. So when we're not podcasting, we're still talking. And every time Andy talks about a new video game movie or project that's coming up, I kibosh it so bad. Because I feel like a certain former president when I say it's never been done before, because we haven't really seen a super great adaptation. We've seen some fun adaptations. We've seen adaptations that are super entertaining,
yeah,
campy, whatever.
Sure.
But I think, Andy, you used the proper term of art, prestige. We haven't seen a great prestige adaptation, right? Like, we saw an attempt maybe with Prince of Persia.
Yeah, yeah.
What, you don't think Sonic the Hedgehog is prestige?
Sonic the Hedgehog is really entertaining, but it is not prestige.
Even after the initial hedgehog that they redid?
They made it passable by removing the terrible hedgehog and replacing it with the better hedgehog, you know? So that's part of the problem, right? So if anyone doesn't know, the original Sonic the Hedgehog, the trailer showed up or the original art showed up, and fans of the game, the original 2D scroller,
yeah,
were really upset with how that looked. And because they were so upset with how that looked and they made their voice known, the people making the film realized that that audience – was the core audience of,
yes,
the film.
Don't, and piss off, like, your core audience.
We're not going to be able to sell this film to the core audience plus, which is how these movies and the adaptations work, right? You want to take the core audience that's already there. That's why everything's being adapted. Yeah. And then you want to expand on that core audience. And if the core audience hates it, you've got a choice, right? So with Star Trek, which has like a ancient core audience, you can reboot the whole thing knowing that the core audience is kind of dying anyway. So let's try to get new people in. But with Sonic, you're trying to get that nostalgia hit in addition to building up new people. And mm-hmm. So they were like, we got to make sure that the audience enjoys what they're going to see. So they took the CGI Sonic character that everybody hated and they re-rendered it in a way that was more reflective of what those people wanted. And it worked out quite well. Everybody's happy, mm-hmm. yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so this balance between trying to get new people into this, and this is why you do something on screen, because there are people who are never going to play a video game, but
yeah,
they will watch the film and they will say, oh, that story's good. And maybe some of them, those people will cross back to the video game, but otherwise you're going to be able to at least take the story and show it to more people. And that's the balance. Like, how do you stay true to the original work, the essence of the original work,
yeah,
while also making it appropriate for screen, so you can't directly literally translate everything, and then, you know, try to widen the audience to people who may not be into video games at all but see this story, yeah, as the kind of thing that they can empathize with, that they can connect to. And that is, you know, we've seen that attempted in Super Mario Brothers in, yeah, 83. Yeah. We've seen it done.
Yeah, 93. Yes.
Yeah, 93. We saw that with, like, there was a chance with Wing Commander back in 99. They gave Angelina Jolie two shots with Tomb Raider, which just was, like, the most ridiculous thing ever. And then there were six attempts with Resident Evil, and they just kind of, like, decided to go their own way with it. And it was just, whoa. Need for Speed, Hitman, you know, Rampage, the field is littered with corpses of attempts,
yes,
at,
yes,
making,
yes,
you know, serious or passable video game movies. And there's been so much that just hasn't worked, you know. Like, you've got the campy stuff like Dead or Alive, you've got the campy stuff like you know, what's it called, Mortal Kombat, and those have cult followings, but
sure.
Bringing the HBO name to a video game, you know, it's a prestige video game, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and bringing that up is difficult. Even, I mean, you can talk about Uncharted, right? That was a prestige video game, AAA and all,
sure,
that stuff.
Yeah.
And the movie was not received well. And I mean, it's part of that maybe, guys, because these are movies, and what they're doing here with The Last of Us is attempting a television show. Talk to me about that.
I don't believe that that's the hang up. I think... Well, first of all, let me backtrack a little and say that I think that there are two types of video games. Well, there are multiple, many, many types of video games. But for the sake, yeah, of adaptation, there's two types. There are video games where the core of the video game is all about the dynamic, where and that's like something like Sonic or Super Mario Brothers. There isn't really a deep lore or storyline involved. And I think those...
You don't think that Mario has a deep storyline? I'm kidding.
I think with ones like that, the pressure is kind of off, and you can kind of be fast and loose, and it's okay, you know? Like, something like Rampage which was a basically a coin op, eighties generation coin op fighting game.
8-bit, yep.
All you had to do was take the essential dynamic of that video game and then make up a story, and you've got the stakes are pretty low. But when you have something that is emotionally moving and has some investment, like The Last of Us or BioShock Infinite or a good deal of the Valve games, I think that the risks are higher. And I think for that, you really need to really have a solid, airtight story. And I think that's the reason, not necessarily TV versus movies.
Sometimes they already have stories, though. So, like, The Last of Us has a story. It's getting that story onto screen in a credible way.
Yeah.
In a way that's going to feel as serious as the video game was. And it's difficult to sell the idea of a serious video game for a lot of people, right? The video game industry is bigger than Hollywood, but it doesn't have the prestige of Hollywood yet.
Right.
So I think trying to bring that through and have it be meaningful to the core audience as well as new people, because if this is done right, it's going to, you know, make some waves. And yeah, it's just very, I don't know, it's very difficult. Tosin, how do you feel about the whole adaptation of video game to screen, to you know, television or film?
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't know that you have too many cases where it's been done for, been done on the media of TV. Usually it is as a film, and more often than not, it seems like it's more of a cash grab to potentially start like a franchise, potentially not Resident necessarily not necessarily like you know, I think at times they do say the right things, but I also feel like often you can tell the studio influence to tailor something to be more of what it is, more money, more of a monetary grab.
Yeah, I mean, but you're talking about Mortal Kombat Annihilation 1997. That's exactly what you're talking about.
But I do think that in this day and age, TV has become, as kind of Andy noted, more prestige than it was before.
Yeah, prestige TV is definitely new. I mean, it's not brand new, but I mean, you know, The Sopranos really started the idea of prestige TV, right? Mm-hmm.
And I think the money that is now spent there, you now have, you know, In the past, the Emmys were seen to be a bit lesser than, say, the Oscars, and I think that's kind of caught up because you have so much quality TV out there and so much TV that really are kind of film extensions. And so this is, to me, this feels like the first real foray into that, into this new sort of world with that kind of lens intact. And so I'm very interested to see how they try and develop it and how they try and create it by extension. And I do think that, you know, HBO has been known for it, but I am kind
known
of
for
known for quality TV.
They've invented prestige TV. Yeah.
But with new ownership now, there's that concern.
The new ownership. This is not the same HBO that gave us Watchmen 2019, is it?
I think, that being said, the
wheels of at least part of the season, if not all of the season, were already kind of rolling before.
That's what I was going to say.
The change in ownership, but you never know, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, I think it's. I think fortunately for The Last of Us, the horses left the barn for them to meddle with season one. But you never know for if this goes into season two. Who knows?
Yeah, I hope they don't turn it into Doom.
Right. Well, I mean, you could name, you know, dozens of other things that they hope. I just hope, because if
Hitman Agent 47.
Yeah. If this goes well, then it could unlock, it could be the, you know,
the Pathfinder, the Trailblazer.
Yes, exactly. The Rosetta Stone or whatever metaphor you want to use that unlocks adaptations, video game adaptations, finally, in my lifetime, I'll finally see it.
But, I mean, there's a lot going on with video game adaptations. Like, we talk about the old ones and how they haven't really worked, but there's no – Hollywood is taking the hammer and they're slamming the nut trying to crack it, right?
Yeah.
You've got a Firewatch movie that's in development. You've got a Duke Nukem film that's been in development forever. There's also Sonic 3. It's already greenlit. There's a Pac-Man film. So you talk about low-stakes storytelling. Yeah. There's a Pac-Man film that's supposed to be showing up. You know, one of our favorites on this podcast, Portal. They're talking about a Portal film. Mm-hmm. And then what's really funny is he's got a whole bunch of Tom Clancy projects, like Ghost Recon and Splinter Cell. And that's a postmodern flip on itself, because Tom Clancy wrote books. And then they asked Tom Clancy to take some ideas from his books and make video games. And then they took the IP and they made video games. And now they're trying to make a movie off of the video games that were based on books, instead of just going from the book directly to the movie. So there's just a whole bunch going on there.
Yeah.
And they're really trying to crack this nut. And I think, Andy, if you get your way, this will be the one. The Last of Us will be the one to crack the nut.
I'm crossing my fingers.
So things that can come out after it are not terrible.
Yes. So I think for me, the main reason that I wanted to podcast about The Last of Us, for me, is that this could be a watershed moment in the history of video game adaptations to screen, and I'm very excited about this. Hopefully I have not put all my chips on the wrong color, but if so, then we can laugh about it like we did with American Gods or other
right. things. I mean, if it's not going to be this one, it's probably going to be Angry Birds movie,
I don't know what else to say after that.
I think we can wrap it up.
All right. So we will release our episodes concurrently with the conclusion of each episode of The Last of Us on TV. So expect within the same week that an episode of The Last of Us is released, that we will have a podcast episode covering that particular episode.
Now we have day jobs, so it may not be the minute it shows up.
Yeah.
The minute the episode airs. Go but give us a little time, and I promise you, you'll get some deep look at each episode.
You can contact us for now at QZPod, which is our Twitter handle, and then we'll give you like all sorts of other links by the time we set all those up. But in the meantime, you can look for us on QZPod. You can look for this episode to be released on Apple iTunes and on Stitcher, and all of the usual places where podcasts are distributed. I think that's it until our very next episode, which hopefully will be which may very well be the first episode of The Last of Us on HBO. All right. Well, thank you for listening. Thank you for allowing us to bend your ears here for a little while. And we will see you guys when The Last of Us premieres.
Totally. I'm gonna fire up the old PS3 and make sure I'm more familiar with it. I gotta get back in the game, literally.
Yeah, I mean, there've been a bunch of re-releases of the game, so if you have
I never bought a PS4.
I'm waiting for the PC re-release, which should be coming.
If it ever happens,
it will be.
They're using it to sell the PS5. This game has got it's given Sony a lot of love.
If they're smart, the PC they'll release the PC adaptation at the same time as the show. By the way, before we sign off, I should mention January 15th is the premiere of The Last of Us on HBO.
Mm-hmm. Right in the heart of snowboarding season.
All right. Thanks, guys. And we'll see you later.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye.